Welcome to the Painting Lines Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture, and from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready?
Hey guys, welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week we brought you the key takeaways from what happened on tour, and this week we have an exciting guest joining us today. Rohan Mendaker, he is the Managing Director of Tennis at Stapleton Sports Group. I actually met Rohan at a Cornell networking event over here in New York City, and we immediately hit it off when he told me he was a sports agent. So Rohan, welcome on.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. So I know your story, but do you mind just kind of going into your career background and how you ended up becoming a sports agent?
Sure. So basically, the funny thing about me is I was never really into sports as a kid at all. My dad tried to get me out, you know, throwing the baseball, anything like that. Just wasn't into it. I've always been on the skinnier side. And, you know, my parents got me tennis lessons. My dad's an avid tennis player. And, you know, he got me tennis lessons. And so I took tennis lessons twice a week for 5 years. Just wasn't really a big fan of it. I didn't like running around, you know, didn't like the heat, and gave it up as soon as I could in high school and college. And then I moved to India to work with a family company, and we belonged to a club out there. And I started hitting around at the club and just kind of fell back in love with the sport. And because I had that, you know, background from coaching, I was able to slip right back in and pick up where I left off. And around that time, I realized the family company really wasn't my thing. We were doing engineering and HVAC stuff, which I don't know too much about. And I love sports. And so I kind of wanted to go along the path of either like international expansion. So like the NBA was expanding in India, something along those lines, or a sports agent was something that I definitely wanted to do. And so I actually moved back to the U.S. and I found an agency being started up in D.C. called Stapleton Sports Group. I joined right in the ground. We started off in basketball, and I joined them. And then we had 8 basketball players. So we're NBA and FIBA certified, which means we can place our players abroad or in the NBA. And because we're a small agency, we don't have any NBA players, but as we kind of expanded and we got all 8 of our players onto teams around the world, we started looking at other sports to expand out. And for me, it was an obvious decision to go into tennis. Although I will say tennis is, it's very consolidated between, you know, IMG, Octagon, those are the big players, you know, even CAA, who's like maybe the 2nd or 3rd largest agency, shut their tennis division down. And so it was kind of a risk to jump into that. But I got lucky because right around that time, they passed the NIL law, which allowed college athletes to make money off their name, image, and likeness. And so I pivoted mainly into college tennis. And that's kind of been a good gold mine of things there.
Yeah, that's a cool story. I think working in tennis is a lot cooler than engineering, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, just can you kind of go into more detail about the service you offer your clients? So I know you said a big part of your clientele is are college players. So like, what would be an example of someone who signs with you and what you can do for them?
So basically, when it comes to NIL, the only thing we're allowed to do is marketing contracts. So as a full service agency, we do specialize in a number of other things. So we even like we have a weightlifter, we organize events for her. With basketball, like I said, we actually negotiate their contracts where we negotiate their room and board, their travel, their food expenses, everything A to Z comes into that contract. With collegiate athletes, it's a lot more marketing. That's all we're really allowed to do under the NCAA. Like even with tennis players, I can't help them get into any tournaments. They're allowed to play certain pro tournaments, but I can't help them pick which ones. I can't give them any guidance on that. The only thing I'm really allowed to do for college tennis players is marketing.
Gotcha. But Stapleton in general does offer like the full service of, you know, contract negotiation. Have you done any like endorsement deals, or is it mostly like creating online content for them? And then, I don't know, I know you said you had a weightlifting client. So like what are kind of the things you would do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of a combination of both. And this is an interesting thing that comes with tennis players. But one of the really big things is actually social media. And it's kind of a shame because you get some really good players who just don't have a really large social media, and then it's kind of tough to pitch them to companies. So really what we do is we have done deals, including myself, where we've partnered with, like, for example, a mattress company for athletes, where they're looking for, you know, they advertise for big and tall people. And our athletes are big and tall, and they've complained that a lot of the stereotypes is that, oh, it's mainly for plus size people, but we want to show that, like, hey, it's also for athletes. And then we've done deals with energy drinks, essential water. We even get our clients on, like, Oprah, Ellen, to promote whatever they're doing. So that's a lot of where we come in.
Yeah, that's neat. I like the mattress because, you know, Sleep Number, obviously they're stacked with NFL players too. I always see, like, Dak Prescott and on there. But no, Essential Water is also a great one. I feel like these are all, like, cool brands that you see in everyday life too. But at Stapleton, if you were to work on someone's social media, is that something that you're personally doing? Or do you guys have, like, an in-house social media content creator that no social media, or do you guys kind of outsource that to another firm? Like, how do you build up a social media?
So we're actually a relatively small agency. We call ourselves a boutique agency because we started off only in 2020, and there was four of us who came on board, and we've had a few interns. And so the social media, a lot of it, we also advise the clients on what to do with their social media. But one of the big foundations of our agency is really letting the athlete be the athlete and who they are authentically. And that's actually something that goes into a lot of our decisions for, like, brand partnerships, as well as, you know, what are your values? Who do you want to work with? What do you want to be representing? And that's kind of where we start and where we look at, you know, brands for that kind of thing. And so we want to kind of have their social media be as authentic to them as possible, because that's something, you know, the audience, their audiences will really connect with.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I have a question about the college athlete aspect. How does that work with professional tournaments? Because players that are amateur athletes and they're playing in professional tournaments, but now they can be paid as well through NIL. How does that work with the payments from a pro tournament versus payments from an NIL deal in terms of their amateur status?
So that's actually a really cool thing. It's especially in tennis, and one of the reasons I feel college tennis is absolutely the future of tennis is they're now allowing, so the top 20 players get 8 challenger spots that they can get into. And so that's a really great opportunity for them to, you know, start their pro career directly from college. Now, the thing is, when it comes to payments, that's where it gets a little dicey. So they're allowed to take only the amount of money that will cover their expenses. So whatever prize money they get from the tournament, they can keep only what would cover their expenses. So I know we'll be talking about João Fonseca, for example, depending on how deep he goes, if he was to still continue with UVA, he'd only be allowed to take the amount of money to cover his expenses to play that tournament.
Hmm. Okay.
Cool. So let's talk scouting, I guess. So what are your, you know, day-to-day responsibilities as a sports agent? I know a lot of it is scouting, right?
Yeah. And so the interesting thing is a lot of people look at sports agents and they're like, oh, Jerry Maguire type of thing. And, you know, you get to travel around. And it is true to a certain extent. I do travel around to universities and to tournaments and, you know, scout players. But a lot of it is actually now online. One of the really cool things is there's a lot of resources available to me and to anyone really to look through. But it's not even just, like I said, anymore about the sport. It's also compiling all sorts of data in terms of what is their career trajectory been? Has it been largely positively up? How are they performing in college? Is it, again, on an upward trend? And a big thing is their social media. And that's actually, you know, a lot of these brands are focusing, they love, you know, football and basketball. And those are the big sports that are getting all the big ticket NIL deals. But what I've kind of done is kind of position tennis as, like, the alternative. So there's one brand that came to us with a sheet saying, we would like a man of color in basketball or football to represent our hair care product. And I said, I have a player in tennis who's a man of color. And, you know, doesn't have the biggest social media following, but especially in the sport where it's traditionally been certain demographics who play and who watch it. We felt it was a really good opportunity to place this player and show him, showcase him for this particular promotion for men's hair care products. And that worked out perfectly because they wanted somebody who was a little bit, you know, against the grain of this typical football basketball thing. And so, you know, you wouldn't expect someone with 3,500 followers to necessarily get a deal, but if you position it right, you know, there's an opportunity there.
Wow. Nice. And so can you talk about the players or the clients that you have that are under 18? Is that something that when they sign a contract with you, are you dealing with them directly or their parents? Because they're technically minors, right?
So it's definitely their parents. And largely, unless the player is for sure going pro, we tend not to work too much with the underage kids because, you know, if they really have, if you're someone like Carlos Alcaraz, where you're definitely going pro, we might look at signing you at an earlier age. But if you're going the college route, it's probably better to just wait until you're in college and you're settled. And then, you know, we also as an agency just want to see your pathway and how it's going. But regardless, at any stage, the parents play a pivotal role. There's a whole process. You have to register with the state. You have to register with the school. You have to then you can contact the athlete or their parents. And again, there's a number of rules surrounding that. But it's largely dealing with the parents and also dealing with lawyers negotiating on behalf of their children.
Wow. Do you think you can speak more on the kind of the college atmosphere and the international aspect? Because I know the U.S. college system draws a lot of international tennis players, right? Because I have a buddy who played at Wagner and he said, you know, 75% of his tennis team was international. So I'm just wondering if you're seeing that as well.
So I think it's become huge. And one of the interesting things is, you know, maybe even like 5 to 10 years ago, especially if you were an international player and you poured in all these resources into a coach and, you know, and your career, if you went to play college tennis, you were a bust. You know, your career was not going anywhere in particular. And so it was really frowned upon by international players and they tended to shy away from going to college if they wanted to make it pro. However, I think recently there's been a huge push with college tennis and people are really seeing the benefits. I mean, you're looking at 70K in travel and another like 100K in private coaching and training and all these people surrounding you in order to get where you need to be. And I think a lot of international athletes are realizing like, hey, if I go to college, I have a great D1 coach who's probably played pro himself, or at least, you know, has been on the circuit in some form or another, who can really help advance my career. All your training, everything is taken care of in college. And so it's a great opportunity for them. And then you have this system set up where it's partnered, where you get the 8 accelerator spots to the ATP challengers through if you're in the top 20. So I think it really gives incentive where it's tough just kind of grinding it out on your own and playing all these tournaments in the hopes that you can get up to the challengers. Whereas if you try the college route, you know, there's a lot of opportunity, especially if you go to a D1 program. But even D2, you can play, you know, D2, D3, you can play solid tennis. They still have in Orlando, you know, the finals for that, and it's equally competitive. And then you can continue to pursue through the ITF futures from there. So there's a number of routes that make sense because you're getting the support that you need around the game and not having to pay out of pocket for it necessarily.
Yeah, that's good news. And I'm glad to see that there are still colleges with tennis teams because I know that they're starting to cut their programs and just make them club because obviously tennis in college is not a very profitable sport. It's not like football or basketball where it brings in all this revenue, but no, it is good to see that that schools are still, you know, having flourishing teams. And
in fact, ESPN just signed a deal to basically on ESPN Plus, they're also going to promote some of the other sports coming out. So they're going to have soccer, baseball, and tennis is actually a big one. So hopefully that'll bring more eyeballs. I know Cracked Rackets has been doing an excellent job also of kind of getting the college tennis name out there. And, you know, just to be honest, from my end, I kind of am a little biased towards college tennis now because you go and you watch it and the atmosphere is just fantastic. I mean, you've got kids playing aggressive. I think the pro tournaments are very much like finesse. Like you look at Djokovic, he's peak of the ATP and it's a very finesse game, right? He hits the right shots. It's the right shots all the time. And maybe in college, it's not always as refined as that, but you get that like raw emotion, aggression, the crowd is into it. And I really like that atmosphere a lot. So, you know, that's something that I've really enjoyed having watched more college tennis now.
Wow. Yeah, it definitely is a raunchier atmosphere, right? Like there's a lot more. It kind of reminds me of like the US Open, the Australian Open, where, I mean, you're playing on a court right next to someone else who's playing too, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you have people celebrating double faults. You have a lot of emotion out there, I feel like.
And your teammate will be screaming like, come on, like right in the middle of your point. So, you know.
Yeah, I think it's also definitely a positive to hear that tennis is growing for college players, because I feel like for a while it kind of seemed almost like college tennis was like an insurance policy on your career, where you're going to go to college and maybe it'll progress into you playing pro, but if you don't, you'll still end up with a degree. But it sounds like it's becoming more and more, they're giving an opportunity for these players to go to college and provide a pathway for them to go pro after that.
Absolutely. And you can take the decision like also in between it. You don't have to finish it out, but it's a good backup option. If you know, you're not quite where you want to be in your tennis game, you can fall back on your degree and you can, you know, really have a good career outside of tennis, or you can also get your degree and continue on and play tennis and try to go that route. But you look at like Ben Shelton or Peyton Stearns, who played only a couple of years of college tennis and then said, hey, I've got good coaching here, but I did really well on the pro circuit, so I'm going to jump out of college and, you know, get into the pro circuit. So it provides a good option either way.
Yeah. Or even like Mickelson did it earlier, but obviously he was going to go to college. He had presented that route. And then he was like, well, it's become clear to me that I'm good enough to play on the pro tour, but he was okay with that option until he obviously found a lot of success.
And you have João Fonseca also, who's the number one, the first ever number one ranked junior player to choose. Obviously now he's gone pro.
Yeah.
But he did choose the college route first. And I still think that speaks volumes to how good these college programs are. And I think if he hadn't had the success that he had on the South American swing, I mean, granted, it was the first couple rounds, but he played really well. And I think it gave him an opportunity to see, you know, okay, I can hang with these big guys and you know, play my game. And I think he's definitely someone to watch also, you know.
100%.
Yeah. So obviously to me, it sounds like you have one of the most fun jobs out there. Do you have like a favorite memory of something that's happened or maybe a cool story that you'd like to share?
Sure. But I will say my favorite memory is actually not from tennis. My favorite memory is actually when we first started, a few of us went for the NBA Summer League to kind of do some scouting there. And that was really fun. I mean, you're in Vegas for one of the coolest weeks for the NBA and just the atmosphere there. And I mean, tennis is fun because it's what I do every day. And I get to sit and watch tennis matches and that never gets old. I'll tell you, like, no matter, it's just really fun to see the new generation come up and watch them play their style of tennis. And each one is kind of unique, but it was cool to do something kind of outside of tennis also with basketball and go for the NBA Summer League. So that was actually one of my favorite memories from the agency. You know, we went early on and we're, you know, a small tight-knit group. And so we had a lot of fun when we went.
Yeah, that's cool. That is cool. So let's shift gears here more. I know you like to focus on kind of the younger generation in your job, but now let's kind of go to the present moment. And I just want to hear your outlook on kind of what we're seeing in America and the American tennis scene. And, you know, which of the Americans you think will be the one to emerge to finally win a Grand Slam?
I think it's a real toss up. I think American tennis has come so far, and you look at the top 50 players in the world and how many American tennis players are in there. And it's really, really cool. But at the same time, it's always just that little edge to, you know, get up there. And it seems like there's a barrier right now where it's just about the top 10. But if I had to, maybe I'm slightly biased, but I love Ben Shelton's game. And I think he's had, in fact, I watched him in Auckland this year. Auckland was really just from last year to this year, watching him in Auckland. I think he made it to the quarters, but he had a much more complete game. He was utilizing the court a lot more. He was coming in. He was playing a lot of shots, not just sitting at the baseline. And so as I've watched him in a lot of these tournaments, and again, maybe I'm biased towards college tennis, but I do think that he's got kind of that college tennis game that's shaking up a little bit. But as he keeps refining it and still keeping that power. I think he's very athletic on the court and has a real chance to make a dent.
Yeah, I agree. I think Shelton definitely has a very explosive game. I mean, I'd probably put myself in the camp of American players are very, very much on the outside looking in at winning a Grand Slam. Because especially if you look at the very top level, it's like it goes up exponentially in terms of even just ranking points as you get to near the top 10. It's like maybe 13th is like around 2,000, and then it's 3,000. And then you look at the top three guys and they're at like 8,000, 9,000. So you're like, there's a difference here. But yeah, I think if I was going to pick one, I'd agree with you. Shelton has a game where it seems like he can explode past players and get these wins that you don't necessarily expect. Whereas someone like Taylor Fritz, we've seen in the past couple of years, he's been able to make runs to quarterfinals, semifinals. I mean, he won Indian Wells a couple of years ago, which is massive, but it doesn't seem like he has the ability in a Grand Slam format to really get past maybe those top guys.
I definitely think it's challenging. I think if he really plays like the tournament of his life, I've seen some flashes of real brilliance in his game, especially his ground strokes, but maybe just developing slightly more of a complete game, I think will really benefit him. I think in this day and age with the racket technology and the string technology, players are focusing more and more on the baseline. And I think it's going to come down to who's starting to adapt their game. I mean, you see Alcaraz, for example, with a lot of drop shots, but once players figure that out, and you're seeing that now in his game, where once players start to figure out kind of your strategies and things like that, unless you're coming in and kind of having a more complete game than just the baseline, I think you're going to struggle a little bit. And I think with American tennis, there's a lot of focus on power. And I see that at a lot of the academies I go to as well, which is really power strokes, right? And hitting hard, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of benefit to that too. But I think constructing a point is really underrated in tennis. And how do you really formulate and construct a point to win it is something that I think the Europeans do really well. Like if you go to Spain, Spanish academies, you know, constructing the point is something they do quite well. So I think whoever starts to focus on the complete game rather than just baseline hitting will have a real advantage as well.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that right now with Sinner. He had a very powerful game. He had crazy powerful ground strokes, but then now it seems like he's being able to maybe even take a little bit of power off and construct points a little bit better. And now he's the past couple tournaments been unbeatable. So I think you're spot on with that aspect.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's really kind of tweaked his game in the right direction. But also speaking to that, if someone is able to figure out, like, that's what I'm kind of hoping for Shelton, is if he's able to figure out that kind of sweet spot between keeping his aggression, because I think that's something that really makes him special in the game, and keeping that intensity and that passion while being able to slightly tweak his shots and make it slightly more accurate, which it seems like he's on the right path to do. I mean, you can always argue that, like, once you're at a certain level, you got to really just hit those clean shots and everything and focus more on that. But I think if you are able to do both and really harness that power, then there's something there, you know.
100%.
Yeah. No, I really resonate with what you said about the Americans emphasizing power, because you see it with Tommy Paul, Tiafo, these massive backswings, and even Jack Sock a few years ago had one of like the hardest forehands on tour, but it didn't really amount to much. So yeah, no, the point construction is huge and kind of underrated for sure in American tennis. So I feel like tennis in general is kind of known for being behind the other sports as far as adapting. You know, you see electric line calling just now kind of becoming part of the sport. You see Netflix having their slam. You see another tour, the UTS, where, you know, it's not conventional tennis rules. Do you think all these are good for growing the sport and keeping it, you know, on the uprise versus the old traditional standard of kind of keeping tennis an elitist, like, classy sport?
So that's a really interesting question. It's one that I've thought a lot about just personally also, is as obviously as an agent and someone invested in the sport, you want to see your sport grow. You want to see the sport you love flourish. I will say it's interesting looking at some of the feedback also, and it's not just from my end, but just looking at some of the feedback that people have, especially on things like Breakpoint on Netflix or you know, the UTS format. And largely the feedback seems to be that people like tennis in its original format, and they like you know, the rules. And kind of one thing I am in complete agreement is we need electric line calling. I think it is beyond time for that. And it's just, it's so important to have that in this day and age. You know, the human eye is good. Don't get me wrong. I like the tradition. That's great. But, you know, just for player peace of mind, especially, I think it'll be really great to have electric line calling. But on the flip side, changing tennis too much also can prove to be controversial, so to speak. And so finding ways to really move the existing formats to a digital age, I think, is what's going to be the more important focus, rather than changing up the style of tennis itself, is just being able to reach more people. And I honestly think one of the big things to do that is just going to be grassroots tennis. I think the way the USTA builds, especially in America, because I think in America, basketball and football, baseball take precedence over tennis. But what you saw during the pandemic, especially, is that a lot of people migrated towards tennis, and they migrated because it was an outdoor sport. And then you see how quickly they fall in love with it. I have friends who just came out on the court and within 2 months were able to get them. I'm not saying they're the best players. And I think, especially compared to a sport like pickleball, tennis is a lot harder to pick up. But at the same time, if you're a natural athlete and you're used to getting out there, you know, figuring out the swing is one thing, but footwork is also important. And so as more people get into tennis and as more people start to appreciate it, they start to watch it. I'm seeing that among my friends. People will come and talk to me and be like, oh, did you see Alcaraz's match? Or did you see Sinner last night? And, you know, when they get into tennis, then, you know, tennis on TV will also benefit from that. And I think you saw ATP kind of do an overhaul on their marketing in the last 2 years. They've tried to make their marketing a lot more young and flashy. And you look at the ATP Next Gen and you see they've kind of got this like flashier format, and they're really trying to push, you know, these documentaries and questions. And if you follow the ATP on YouTube, they have like kind of these behind the scenes questions and fun things that they're doing to really give you more of access to these players and have them have you understand what they're thinking and what their likes and dislikes and who they are as people. And I think that's really going to be the key going forward, is how to take this old sport and not necessarily change it, but kind of bring it into the modern age without changing up too much of what makes tennis great in the first place.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's probably our main goal with this podcast too, just taking tennis, digesting it, and essentially trying to grow the sport. You know, I have three roommates who have never watched a tennis match before in their life before living with me, and now they're kind of obsessed with tennis too. Like, it is so much fun to get out there. And it was funny you mentioned pickleball. Like, I love the reference about pickleball being checkers and tennis being chess, you know, because it is a hard sport. You know, no one, you can't just go out there with a racket and pick it up. Whereas pickleball, you know, you play 30 minutes and you're pretty damn good already if you're coordinated.
Yeah. But I will say, and I have no hate towards pickleball. I love anything that gets people out and playing. I know that might be a controversial thing among tennis fans, and don't get me wrong, I'm a diehard tennis fan. But I have played pickleball a few times at my club, and it's a fun sport, and anything that gets families together and gets people active and out there, you know, I don't have a problem with that so much. But I can understand neighbor noise complaints, that makes sense. But I think if you're playing tennis and you get that distracted by pickleball going on next door, then I don't know how much it is about your tennis game versus the pickleball game.
Yeah. And I like what you said about the electronic line calling, because we've talked about that before. And my comparison for it is, like, you look at other sports where they need a referee, like basketball, like football, where it's a live moment that where they're making a call at their own discretion. Whereas a line call, it's either true or false. It's not like the line umpire can say, I think it was in, and even if it wasn't, we're going to call it in. It is either in or out, and it's very clear, and a video analysis camera system can do that. It doesn't need a person to be there saying whether it was in or out.
Yeah, it was so funny. I was watching the Rude Runa match in Acapulco, and Rude had a serve that was like clearly in, but there was an out call by the line judge, and he obviously challenged it, and they did the replay, and it was inside the box, like barely even on the line. And the umpire's looking at the iPad, like shrugging with their palms up, like, why was that even called out?
I think it can even get like to a point where it gets too heated, like with Rublev, you know, this past tournament. I thought that was, interesting all the way around in terms of how that was handled. And even with these other sports, you look at football and basketball, and the main complaint that people have these days is like the refereeing, right? Oh, they didn't call that, but they called that. And like, oh, they called this holding call in football, but they didn't call it for the other team, or they didn't call. And that seems to be such a point of contention, is when you have humans judging other humans, there's going to be some bias or some error, and it's just human nature. And I think eliminating kind of the doubt in that will be beneficial, not just for tennis, but a lot of sports, you know, is if there is any sort of controversy, can we go back, replay, or like, you know, check the replay? And with tennis anyways, I think within the next year, it's all going to be electric line calling for the men's side. I think the women's side are still going to hang on to some tournaments. We'll have the traditional line calling.
Yeah, I actually saw a funny thing. A professional football player was talking about in the scouting, in the leading up to their games, they would not only scout the other team that they were going to be playing against, but they also got scouting reports on some of the refs that were going to be in the game. So it would be like, hey, if you're a quarterback, this ref calls more pass interference calls. So let it go and just throw it long. Maybe you'll get a call. Or they don't call as much holding. So maybe if the guy's going to get past you, hold him a little bit and you'll see if it doesn't get called. But that's something that I don't think is probably not great for that sport.
And it's led to all these accusations of like the script and stuff like that, you know? And I think if you're trying to have fair outcomes in sports, and especially with the prevalence of sports betting, you know, it's important to make sure that you get a lot of those calls right. And there's not a lot of room for error. I mean, we judge the athletes very harshly. And I'm not saying, but there needs to be a lot more scrutiny on the refs as well, and making sure that, because these athletes are literally in high pressure moments that they've trained their whole lives for. And in tennis, it's such a mental game. You're the only person out there. And if you have somebody whose literally only job is to call the in or out and they get it wrong, those real intense passions and emotions can come out in the wrong kind of ways. And that's not good for the sport image, or for, you know, the lines people who have to call it, or the player.
100%.
Yeah, I don't know a single player that is not in favor of electric line calling.
Yeah.
As the title suggests, this is a two-part episode. But be sure to check back next week to hear some more from Rohan, his experience as a tennis agent, and his thoughts on the current state of tennis. But for now, let's skip to segments.
All righty, you ready to hop into segments?
Yes, I am. So what's new into tennis this week? I saw something pretty interesting because it was kind of on my radar for a bit, and I didn't know if it was actually going to happen. But so it was confirmed that the Saudi Arabia's public investment fund announced a five-year partnership with the ATP Tour. The financial details weren't disclosed. We don't know how much money was invested, but here's what we do know, that they have naming rights of the rankings. So previously it was Pepperstone, which is an Australian brokerage or trading house, and they are partnering with five events, ATP events, the Miami Open, Indian Wells, Madrid, Beijing, and the ATP Finals. So I think I have mixed feelings about this. I think it's good for, like, obviously the growth of the sport. It's going to open up a lot more opportunities monetarily. And, you know, I think it has a good part to do with the youth aspect as well. But on the other side, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't have the best human rights record. And I think this is the perfect example of sports washing. So, you know, they don't hold up great with LGBTQ rights. You know, they even responsible for that murder of the Washington Post journalist a few years ago. So I don't know how I feel about this. I wasn't too keen on it when I first heard about it originally, that it was possibly going to happen, but I want to hear what you guys think. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think that
mixed bag.
That's the greatest, hearing all those things you just mentioned. But I think in the end, it's a very complex issue, and it's something that I'm not fully informed about. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say something that might be incorrect.
That's fair. Rohan?
Well, here's kind of my take on the whole thing. Without getting too much into politics or anything like that, I think you could argue that tournaments take place in a number of countries with perhaps, you know, spotty human rights records or issues that have happened in their country. And I can understand the idea of sports washing, but at the same time, you know, I think Saudi Arabia has really been trying to rehab their image. I've been looking, and they're actually the first Middle Eastern country that have said they're going to welcome LGBTQ members. They put it on their website saying, you know, we welcome gay, lesbian, et cetera, people into our country. Now, whether they follow through on that and make sure, you know, I think the world is watching, definitely. But, you know, they've been pushing to get women to drive. And, you know, I think the Middle East in general gets a fairly bad rep, you know, especially in America. But I also think that, you know, I've been to a few of these countries, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and well, that's the same country, but, you know, a few of these cities. And I genuinely think that if they can, you know, work on a lot of these issues that have come up, then I think sports is one of those things that's a real unifying thing. And so if they're able to use sports as a way to like kind of present themselves again to the world and say, hey, you know, this is, we're trying to be more friendly. We're trying to create these international bonds. You know, I don't think that's a bad thing. However, I think a very key thing that needs to be done is they can't just throw money at these sports, right? Like that seems to be a lot of what they throw money at golf. They throw money at F1, they throw money at tennis. And I don't think they're really investing in these sports in the way they should be. I will say, I know they've brought on Nadal now as a representative for the country, and he's going to come in and actually teach kids and help them develop the sport. And if they can really stick to that and build grassroots tennis and build really roots in these sports and not just have them as a spectacle and as a tourist thing, but really invest in making sure that kids, both boys and girls, importantly, have access to these sports, can play these sports without, you know, any issues, and can really promote it, then I think you'll have a robust, you know, community that can come out and actually enjoy these sports for what they are. And as well, you'll have representatives from the country then who may have a chance. I think they had Shell Bayat. I don't want to mispronounce his name either, but yeah, he's from Jordan, I believe. And it was cool to see the support he got from the Middle Eastern crowd there. And so if they can really build the sport in the area, you know, the Middle East can absolutely have a really robust tournament schedule, you know, where, and, you know, Dubai, of course, given the population that lives there, and even Qatar, you can argue, have a built-in expat population that can help support it. But Saudi Arabia, I believe, has, you know, not quite a robust expat population as those. So to really build the sports that they're, you know, throwing money at there, I think would be a good thing.
Yeah. And it's not just happening in tennis. I mean, like you said, like in soccer or football, whatever you want to call it, they've been massively just buying a bunch of top known players. Like you said, though, it hasn't been, I think, as successful as they were hoping, because a lot of those players seem to be noticing that they get there and it's not as much of a crowd involvement. It's much more of a empty stadiums. They're getting paid a lot to play here, but the atmosphere that they're used to playing in Europe isn't there. But yeah, like you said, if they're able to kind of transition that from not just having the best players, but also just growing the sports scene overall in soccer and in tennis and in golf, then I think, yeah, it could be very successful for them.
Yeah, well said. Well said. What did you see this week, Aiden?
Yeah, what I saw was a little bit less serious, but we kind of already touched on it. It was about João Fonseca turning pro rather than going to college. And yeah, I mean, I don't really have much to say about this now that we've already talked about.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, tennis is super interesting because then, you know, it's not like football or basketball where you have to go to college to go pro. Like tennis, you have the option, and granted it's global, so not everyone like has access to college, but yeah, pretty interesting dynamic with the option to go to college or the option to go pro here.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing for me is, so nearby in Maryland, actually, there's the JTCC, which is the Junior Tennis Champion Center in College Park, Maryland. And one of the things I love actually about living in this area, and specifically for my job, is they have the ITF Junior Championships here every year. And so it's really cool because you get players from all over the world. And for the past 3 years, you know, Zhao and his team have come out, and it's been really cool because I've met him, I've met his team, and he's just such a down-to-earth, nice guy. When you watch his matches, you know, he really has, again, that mentality that I was talking about with Sinner. You know, and Alcaraz also smiling. Just he's got that very calm demeanor, and he's got such a great game. I mean, I saw him, I think, when he was the sixth seed a couple of years ago, and I was like, this kid is going to win it. And he went on to win it because he just has, you know, a lot of these qualities, I think, that you'd want to have out of it. Like, he's one thing that really struck me is he made Clay look fast. I couldn't believe some of his shots, you know, like he made Clay look, you know, quick. And that was, I think one of the commentators said that, I don't want to take credit for that comment, but he really, I mean, the way he hit those strokes, it was a thing of beauty. And with these, you always wonder, because I think he would have had, you know, a really good opportunity under Coach Pedroso also to, you know, maybe play for 1 or 2 years, really develop his game, develop his physique. But I think one of the interesting things about dominating in tennis as a junior is you go from being scrappy. Like, you look at these tournaments that he played, he was kind of the underdog, I guess you could say, in the tournaments, right? The new kid on the block, who's very good, don't get me wrong. But when he's in college, he's going to be the top dog, right? Everybody's gunning for him. So they have nothing to lose, just like he had nothing to lose in like these tournaments, right? And so it'll be interesting for him to face that kind of pressure, you know, where everybody's coming for him. And college tennis, I mean, we know is an aggressive place, you know? And so I'd have been curious to see how he grows and develops there. And I still would not have faulted him, you know, for going it. I understand his reasoning for going pro, and especially given, you know, the fact that, like I said, he can hang with the big dogs, so to speak. But I also think, you know, that if he had gone the college route, he could have really developed his game well there too.
100%.
So you said he plays fast. Do you think his game would have translated pretty well to hard courts, or do you think he's going to be one of those clay court specialist guys?
So it's interesting you say that, because the tournament, or the ITF Junior Championships, are played on hard courts. And even there, he played really well, and he played hard and he had a lot of power. It was interesting because I've seen him play on hard courts, and hard courts are naturally faster. And so I already thought he was a great player on the hard courts, but just seeing him on clay, which I hadn't seen him before, was like a huge eye opener for just how, you know, some of those shots he hit. And again, just little tweaks, but he's another player where I feel he has the power and he's already got a ton of the precision he needs, right? Like, there's a lot of other little bits of refinement, maybe like his serve and things, but he's got that power and precision perfectly balanced, where if he hits those shots, you know, and continues to practice, I think he can really develop a game that is a sweet spot with both.
Yeah, this might be a little bit of a tangent, but before, what we were talking about American tennis, like, maybe what American tennis can do better at is getting players exposure to clay courts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But
that's a big issue in the U.S. No clay courts. I feel like every American player has played 9,000 matches on a hard court and then like 3 on clay.
And it's interesting because, you know, I grew up learning tennis on clay. The club that I was coached at was clay courts, but it's the Hartrud clay, right? Which is also plays very different from red clay. And the red clays outside of like a few country clubs are very difficult to find, you know? And I love playing on clay. I think it's such an underrated surface. In fact, Roland Garros is actually my favorite slam, more than even Wimbledon. I just love how clay kind of evens out everybody's game and gives everybody kind of a chance to, you know, show their skills rather than just, again, whacking the ball back and forth. And so, yeah, I'm a big fan of clay personally, and I would love to see more American players get the opportunity to play on it. And I think that'll really, I agree, I think that'll really help their game.
Yeah. You might even argue, like, because clay slows it down, it would help them learn to construct points better. Yes. Because you can't just always hit the ball past someone on a clay court. It'll just get slowed down. They can get behind it. And all of a sudden, that ball that's a winner on a hard court is just another shot on a clay court.
That's an excellent point, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So next segment, bet of the week, we are actually skipping this week.
Yeah. We were looking at the bets, and it was kind of like, okay, we can bet on qualifiers at Indian Wells or a challenger somewhere. And we try to avoid betting on those challengers just because, yeah. We know very little about the players, so we'd kind of just be throwing a shot in the dark there.
Fair enough.
Yeah. But no, generally, we have a pretty good hit percentage for our.
Yeah, I think it's actually increased a lot too recently. Yeah. I think earlier on in the podcast we were a little bit more like throwing something out there and then go 0-2 and just be like, oh well, move on from that. But I think we've been improving on that. But
sports betting is just massive nowadays too, so it's a huge appeal to a lot of people. I know that. I know I have friends who always like will text me when the big slams are happening, like, yo, what are some good bets? You got any parlays cooked up? Like, they're really interested in it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, now we can hop into match of the week. Yeah. So,
who'd you go for this week?
Dude, I went with the Umber sustaining Hurkacz, 3-6, 7-6, 6-4. And I say sustain because Hurkacz took the first set 6-3 pretty easily. And then the second set went into a tiebreaker. And, this is pretty funny. It wasn't funny at first, but it's funny now that he's all right. But Hurkacz actually like took a pretty bad fall when he was going to get a point. He ended up like trying to jump over the bench, just ate shit, you know, did not look graceful at all. I feel like some players like Monfi or, you know, someone else could have easily like, jumped over the bench, made it look pretty cool. But Hurkacz just tipped right over. And, you know, Umber, I thought, had a pretty classy move going over to check on him, like high-fiving him, making sure he was all right. And then later on in the tiebreak, he actually had three separate match points that he pushed long. Like, it wasn't even Umber hitting winners. Umber was just kind of hanging in these long rallies, which, you know, credit to him, and then forcing Hurkacz to make the mistake. And then so Umber actually won the second set tiebreaker, and at that point, the momentum has completely shifted to Umber's side. He had an early break in the third and then just never looked back from there. But I think it's pretty crazy because he went on to win that tournament despite being down three match points earlier on in there. And I think that just shows like his nerves of steel and the fact that, you know, Hurkacz is a great player and Umber just kind of outlasted him, I felt like. It's an exciting match.
It's like Bublik winning that tournament earlier in the year after losing the first set in every match.
Yeah, no, it was exciting. So if you guys haven't seen it, I definitely recommend going back to watch the highlights. What did you see this week?
Well, not to play the same tune over and over again. I almost should change my name of this portion just to the Murray match of the week because I always go with Murray. The Murray match. But I'm going with Murray beating Shapovalov.
He won this time too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's definitely a positive. But I just starting it off, I think Murray's last couple of losses have been really tough because he lost to Umber, who won the tournament, and then he lost to Mensik, who made the final. So it's like he's that close to having a lot of success in these tournaments, but he ends up losing to the guy that makes these big runs. But the match with Shapovalov, a lot of entertaining points. I just think it's crazy how Murray can, even at 35 and with a busted hip, can just still play that game where he gets to every ball and forces these super long rallies and is able to stay in these matches. But so in the first set, Shapovalov broke late and just took it. It was a very normal set. Like, they held a lot, and then Shapovalov broke late and took it. And then in the second, Murray actually broke him early, but then was immediately broken back, and it ended up going to a tiebreak. And Murray got his first set point and just jumped all over it and won it, sent it to a third. And then, like you said, with the early break in that third set, that's kind of follows that pattern we've talked about. If the guy can win the set in a tiebreak, get an early break, it's a lot easier for them to just hold that out because they have used their momentum to get the break, and then they just have to hold their serve essentially to get through the end of that match.
Yeah, they feel defeated, you know, like everything's kind of not going their way, and then the fact that they just had to play a long tiebreaker, and in Hurkacz's position, he almost won the match. He was so close three times to just closing out the match and couldn't do it. Now he's got to play a whole nother set.
Yeah, so definitely tough mentally.
Think about tennis.
I know.
Anywhere else you can be up by that much, basketball and you know, time running out, but tennis, there's no clock. And
I know, and that's what I saw a clip of Tiafoe. That was one of his reasonings why tennis is the hardest sport.
Yeah,
because you don't know how long you're going to be out there. Like you said, there's no clock. But
also, just as a quick tangent as well, from my Francis Tiafoe, again from the same area, he trained in the JTCC in Maryland. So I've always had, like, I always root for the guy. I always hope as well, because it's kind of cool, you know. He always reps the Wizards jerseys and the Commanders and everything. So you know, and I've met him also a couple times at the JTC, and just the nicest guy. Like, whatever you see on TV, you know, he's just a really nice guy in person also.
Genuine. Yeah, I don't know if you've noticed, but he's bulked up too. He looks fucking jacked now. He loves wearing the muscle shirts. Rohan, I appreciate you coming on, man. This was super fun. Love talking tennis with you. You know, I know you're on social media. I know, you know, Stapleton Sports Group as well. So if you want to be found, where can people find you on social media? Maybe, you know, reach out to you for anything.
Sure. I will say, as far as social media goes, we've not been very good at upkeeping that. I'll be honest, for Stapleton Sports Group. So I would recommend, if anybody just wants to check us out, you can give us a follow. We're at Stapleton SG. That's S-T-A-P-L-E-T-O-N. Spelling class. Stapleton SG on Instagram. And we're also StapletonSportsGroup.com. That'll give you a lot of information about what we do. But I think we have like one post of our logo rotating or something. we're active more behind the scenes, honestly. And considering we do marketing, we should probably work on our social media too. But if you want to find me personally, I upkeep my own Instagram to a certain extent. And I'm at ROHVN. So like an upside down A, because I'm cool like that.
Social media move.
Exactly. I've had that name forever now. Like,
he's hip.
And, since college. And if you want to, it's mainly just like, I like to take pictures of like nice tennis courts around the world when I go.
Oh, yeah.
I always actually pack my rackets and, you know, try and get a game in wherever I go. I've played in India and Switzerland, Alaska. So it's pretty fun. You know, I'll like Google and see what the most beautiful tennis courts are in the area and see if I can, you know, get in and play there. So nice. That's something I like to do just for fun.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming on.
And thank you so much for having me. This was really fun. Love talking tennis with you guys, and hope to do it again soon.
Yeah, for sure. All right. And that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. Feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.